Sweet. What, live? Like people can hear me and see me kind of live? Very cool. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Midweek Live. We are talking about UFC 280. You'll have to excuse me, I have double hoodie today because it is freezing in here. I don't know why, but it is. Okay. Ask me your questions in the chat. You can tweet them at me. Well, I'm just going to have a casual chat with you guys about UFC 280 because there's a lot to talk about. My first thing I'm going to say is I am a little concerned to see Charles Oliveira is already in the sauna, and it is only Wednesday. If he's saunering now, that means he's either, I don't know. I don't know what the plan would be. The only time I've known someone to start saunering that early was when I fought Anthony Johnson, and he was cutting about 40 pounds. And I hope it's not, he's not cutting that much, but ultimately there's not really much of a benefit in starting your dehydration cut at this point because you don't want to be dehydrated. I mean, I even thought it was crazy. Some fighters would do their weight cut for a Friday afternoon weigh-in. They would start their weight cut on Thursday night and sleep dehydrated. I always thought that was crazy as well. Like, you want to be dehydrated for as little time as possible. And there's not really much benefit in sitting in a sauna aside from to sweat. And it's hot enough out there as well. Hello, everybody who's in the chat already. So I've got a few questions on Twitter already, so I'll answer a couple of these because there are some good ones. Am I looking forward to hearing Caitlin go hi-ya her whole fight? I don't think she's going to be saying hi-ya for the whole fight. I think she's going to get kicked in the guts and probably not want to keep shouting anymore. What else? If something happens to Gamrot versus Dariush, can or will Volkanovski step in? I don't think he will. I think now he's been promised that title shot. I think he's going to be waiting for that opportunity. You know, it's nice. It's a nice tease to have him out there. But of course, we all want Oliveira and Makhachev to fight. But the idea of Volkanovski being the next contender is very exciting because, you know, and of course, Charles Oliveira's response about going down to 45 and taking him on there as well, taking his belt. You know, I think he's a problem at 155 as well. I think the way he moves, I think the speed he sets and the pace that he sets, it's a handful for anybody, no matter what weight class. Hello, everybody in the chat. So if you've got questions, give me a shout in the chat. Okay, here we go. Union Rizzo. So, Sugar versus Yan. What realistically happens? You know, I think this is a difficult fight over three rounds for Yan because I think he's not going to want to close distance really quickly on Sean O'Malley because O'Malley has got punching power. He is elusive. He's difficult to pin down. He's got that bouncing back and forth up against the fence. I mean, it's just not a safe person to close down very quickly. And I think that, you know, O'Malley's probably going to be able to stay on his bike as long as his lower body doesn't get damaged, as long as he doesn't get injured, you know, calf kicked or ankle rolled or something. If that happens, then of course he's going to be a sitting duck for Petr Yan and the way that he fights. But at the same time, over 15 minutes, I feel like Sean O'Malley has got enough gas and enough footwork and enough sharp shooting style striking to be a real problem for Petr Yan. Especially if Yan's just not giving him the respect that he deserves, which might be the case. You know, Petr Yan might be sitting there watching the Aljo Dillashaw fight. He might have wanted to have been on this card to make sure that he was there as a potential backup in case one of those guys fell out. I could quite easily see him looking past Sean O'Malley. I think it would be a mistake to underestimate him. I really do. yeah, Yan Dillashaw, at Floski, definitely. That is the fight that I want to see. I mean, I'm interested in the Aljo fight. I am leaning towards Dillashaw in that one, although I do think it's going to be a very competitive fight. But the truth is, if I could pick any fighters on the card to face one another, I would want to see Dillashaw facing Petr Yan. Like, the way they both occupy the same space. They both move forward. They both switch stances. You know, it's a... It's a really intriguing battle, that one, you know, and perhaps if Dillashaw comes through this one and Petr Yan beats Sean O'Malley, which honestly I think would be easier for him over five rounds than three, but, you know, that's just my take on it. Yeah, that's the fight I want to see, Dillashaw, Petr Yan. Okay, what do we got here? Okay, Vanguard. The probability that Olives wins by TKO starting with a knee. You know, I think knees up the midsection are going to be a real useful weapon for him, because ultimately he doesn't really mind if you take him down. Makhachev's really good at timing people, so they're either throwing an inside low kick or they're stepping when he level changes. Like, you look at the way that he knocked out Gleison Tibau, he hit him, and the way that Gleison Tibau falls was, I mean, his feet were together. It was because he was throwing a kick at the same time. He'd thrown a punch to a kick, and he got nailed with the cross. Same thing with Dan Hooker. If you watch that fight, it was Makhachev hit him with the lead right hook and then level changed and took him down. Like, he's very good at timing people when they bring their knees together. But if you're Oliveira, you don't really mind getting taken down. Why would you not put those knees in the midsection? And also, you know, it breaks posture because he might be able to start wrapping over the top of the head. You remember the opening seconds of the Gaethje fight. He comes out, cracks him with that right hand, rocks Gaethje for a second, then he closes him down. He's kneeing, he's uppercutting the midsection, then he's trying to climb over him all the time, trying to get over his head and over his neck. Absolute nightmare. Okay, what else have we got? Matsu, I'm going to call you Matsu. Thank you for the donation. Dan, do you think the hot, humid environments will adversely affect fighter performance? And if yes, how? You know, I think the only thing it would maybe affect is the rehydration. You've got to think, like, the hotels over there are vast. They've got great air conditioning. You know, there's going to be plenty of rehydration equipment, stuff around for them. All the fighters are giving packages after they weigh in with all their rehydration salts and gel sachets and different kinds of things. Unless they're out sightseeing, that's my concern. Like, being in the sun too much, you don't want to be in the sun too much during fight week. You know, a bit of sunshine, take a walk around, absolutely. But you want to be resting as much as you can. And you want to be rehydrating if you're sweating. And it is difficult to stay hydrated out there, especially if you're out, you know, on jet skis and that kind of stuff. I think depending on how you spend your fight week will depend on how much you're affected by the environment, how much time you spend outside. And then as it comes to fight night, what tends to happen with those arenas is they tend to switch the air conditioning off as they're doing the building. So as they're bringing in the octagon and setting all the tables around and everything, the air conditioning switched off because the big shutter doors are open. But then once the octagon's set up and everything, the shutter doors come down, then they turn the air conditioning on. So it actually gets better as the night goes on, which is fortunate because the crowd gets busier. So, you know, I don't. It's not going to be nearly as bad as UFC 242. Was it 242, Jamie? In Khabib Poirier. Yeah, 242, wasn't it? Was it 241? The one in the massive tent in the desert, that was sweltering. Because of course this is a big like artificial structure, and they struggled to keep it air conditioned. It was either freezing cold or just way too hot. A really difficult environment to fight in, but not this one. I think this is a relatively modern arena. It is a relatively modern arena. 242, yeah. Testing my knowledge here, Jamie. Okay. Kikzu 3. What do you think of Dariush v. Gamrot? I'd love to hear War Room about it. Honestly, I could have done a War Room for every fight on this card. There are a lot of really interesting ones. This is one that I'm absolutely keeping my eye on, along with Bilal Muhammad, Sean Brady. I think that's a really intriguing one as well. Keep an eye on Gamrot. I don't really need to say much more than that, to be honest. Benil Dariush is a problem for anybody because of how technical he is, how smart he is. You know, he's got a very high fight IQ. He's got good conditioning. He's able to work into the third round and keep pushing people. Gamrot is lethal. He's very skilled. He's very technical. He fights comfortably out of both stances. He can box moving forward as well as moving backwards. He's got good counter hooks as he's stepping. I mean, you know, if you want to watch a fight that you might have not seen, go and watch him against Norman Park in KSW. The third one is the one to watch. He really does put a beating on him in a short period of time, and he's got the wrestling and grappling to back it up. I think that this is going to be the moment we all see how good Gamrot is. Unfortunately for Benil, because I don't think he's going to get any closer to the belt than he is at this moment. Someone needs a little Jamie in their life. That's what they're saying in the chat, Jamie. I don't know what to do about that. Okay, Bob. A lot of discussion has been around how Islam wins late. And I get with him on top, Charles will tire. However, What is Olive's cardio like? His pace versus Dustin was insane. Yeah, it was absolutely. And this is why we keep circling back to the weight cut conversation on the channel, because, I mean, I keep bringing it up. It really depends on how his weight cut goes. It depends on what condition he arrives into fight week. Like, you've got to think, he's got to make 155 on the button, otherwise he's not fighting for the belt. Even if he weighs in 156, 157, I expect this fight to go ahead, but then he won't be, you know, he won't be eligible for the championship. The other thing you have to consider is, even if he makes 155, if it was such an arduous task to get down there, we don't know how well he's going to recover, how quickly he's going to recover. And then that starts to affect your performance as you go into the fight. Like, I remember having one fight. He was against a very, very tough individual, a guy called Danny Rushton, and I knew he cut a lot of weight. So I allowed myself to stay really big in training camp all the way through. I did a lot of heavy lifting and I allowed myself to be heavy. But then when it came to fight week, I think I cut 14 pounds on the day to make weight. And I woke up on fight day and I'd hydrated and I'd done everything I could. And I remember walking up the steps into the cage thinking to myself, I've got 5 minutes. Because you just know that your body's not responding as well as it should be. You know it's not firing as well as it should be. And I think sometimes that's why Charles starts fast. You know, he did well against Dustin Poirier, but he also, from what we know, didn't struggle with the weight cut. But with, with Justin Gaethje, regardless of what we think about the weight, you know, it was a struggle for him. It generally is. And when he struggles with the weight, he tends to struggle with his gas tank into the third round. You know, even fights where he's won, one fight where he won, went the distance and missed weight was Jeremy Stephens. And you can see in that third round, he's crashed. He just did enough in the first two to be able to win the decision. Good question. Okay. Cheetah versus Merab for the interim title. Yeah, why not? Why not? Okay. Oh my goodness, so many questions. Where do I start? Okay. Why does Islam look so much bigger than Charles when Charles has a harder time making weight? I mean, it can be down to a lot of things. It can be down to the way that your body responds to the weight cut. It depends on how you do it and when you start. You know, I mean, say if both fighters have got 10 pounds to cut, and one fighter decides they're going to start on Tuesday night, which it looks like Oliveira did. That means that he's going to be gradually dehydrating and he's not going to be on top form all the way through fight week. Makhachev might decide to himself, okay, I'm going to water load, I'm going to be real strict with my diet, and then when it comes to Thursday, I'm going to stop drinking water, my body will be super hydrated, it'll be ready to sweat, and I will just naturally comfortably dehydrate myself with a bit of hard work, good sweat, good workout, and then you start rehydrating. And that feels like a much more natural process for the body than it would if you're like sweating out night after night. You know, that's really the big question. I mean, I think Makhachev is probably just as big as Charles. You know, they're the same height. Charles has got, what, a 4-inch reach advantage. They're pretty much, you know, they're pretty much, you know, fairly evenly matched. I would say that Makhachev's probably got a little bit more muscle on his upper body. But then Charles Oliveira's got really strong legs as well. So, you know, muscle distribution's another thing. I do think that him, if he's already in the sauna though, that's not a good sign. That's not a good sign at all. And that might further support the idea that he's going to be very aggressive from the start. I think Oliveira is going to be the one that starts the grappling exchanges. I really do. It's an interesting fight. Okay, I've got a few more questions on here. I don't see how anyone can seriously believe O'Malley has a path to victory. So I guess that's my question. How? From Ike Turner. I think he stays on his bike. I think he stays lateral moving, and he picks and he pokes and he tries to get PT Yan frustrated and swinging and missing. I mean, he's got height and reach advantage. As long as he can maintain some space for Yan, doesn't get backed up against the fence, doesn't get caught with that single necktie that Yan's so good at, I think he can steal rounds. I think he can definitely win the first two rounds, and then we'll see Yan in the third round really getting aggressive and being impatient and trying to push forward. And that might work out even worse for him. You know, I mean, my safe money, of course, is with Jan, but I can't at all count out O'Malley to be able to, you know, do enough to win. It's a big step up for him, I admit, but at the same time, I think the fact that that Jan is looking at him and knowing it's a big step up for him might mean that he'll underestimate him. Okay. Okay, so do you think Islam will shut down Olive's jiu-jitsu? How often do wrestlers get caught in some submissions when you train? I mean, the thing is, like this, we can't forget. I mean, Makhachev is a very well-rounded martial artist. You know, the fact that he's got a sambo background means that he's been dealing with takedowns into submissions, striking into takedowns for a long, long time. I also have seen several times in his career where he's been caught in things. You know, you look in the UFC, you're looking at Nick Lentz, you're looking at Chris Wade. You know, both people were able to get his neck wrapped up. And if you want to go before the UFC, go and watch his fight against Barnui, where he was in triangles and arm bars and all kinds of different tangled up situations where he was able to work his way through. I think he's a very aware grappler. I just don't think we see the depth of his grappling game because he's very linear with it. He's very direct. You know, he knows what he wants to do. He knows what works. 46% of the time he's in top position, you know, 4% of the time bottom position. Oliveira is about 25-25. I think that we know what Makhachev does, and he does it really well. And I think he stays on a tightrope on a game plan, and he makes it work for him. I think Oliveira just kind of flows. You know, he kind of throws himself into the fire because he knows he's got good grappling. He knows he's got good striking, and he knows that he can take a shot. It doesn't faze him when he gets dropped. It's that's what makes him such a difficult fight fights to take on. Okay. Manon, KO or TKO Chookagian, or do you think she'll be able to outpoint her? I mean, I think this is a really tough fight for Caitlin Chookagian. I can absolutely see Manon Farreau coming in and being aggressive, closing her down, hitting her with that side kick over and over again, the midsection, and hurting her, and then backing her up against the fence, and then just unleashing that aggressive flurry of jab, cross, hook, jab, cross, hook, jab, cross, hook. You know, and I think she's also got the takedown defense to be able to keep it standing. I think this is going to be a good fight for her, to be honest. Her aggression and power is what outweighs her in this fight between her and Chookagian. I'm going to have a quick drink. What we got here? Ken Mamba, Good Day Outlaw. Hello, Ken Mamba. Hang on. Where are you gone? There you are. Who do you think is an easier matchup for Volk when he moves up to lightweight? Yeah. I mean, I assume that we're talking about the main event fighters and, you know, who's going to have the belt afterwards. I think that there are benefits and drawbacks to both of them. I think the benefit with Oliveira is that you can get to him. You know, he's not going to use his height and reach advantage. He's going to put himself right in the pocket against Volk, and he's going to take shots to land shots. I think Volk will probably be able to keep it standing for the most part, unless he just gets too caught up in a brawl in the pocket, because that's when Oliveira is going to wrap him up. I think Makhachev's a really difficult fight for Volkanovski, but I think his footwork is what makes the difference. I think his speed and his pace, we have no questions about Volkanovski over five rounds. I think he'd be able to keep moving and keep kind of buzzing, you know, in and out of range, switching his stance, chopping the leg. I think he'd be such a headache for Makhachev to deal with. Makhachev would then start just using those long range kicks to set up his boxing before his takedowns, and I think that natural path would be easy for Volkanovski to deconstruct. You know, he knows what to expect from Makhachev. Oliveira is way more chaotic, but he's also way more available as an opponent. He's a lot more hittable. If I'm Volkanovski, I would much rather have someone that is there available for me to land my shots. Somebody asked me this the other day, and you know, this is why I like your questions, because they get my brain thinking in different directions. Someone said, who would you rather be and who would you rather fight out the two of them? And the answer is the same for both questions. I would rather be the fighter that Charles Oliveira is. I like that chaos, but I like the depth of his skill set as well, and the fact that he's able to just throw it on the fire. Like, if you take 70% of who Charles Oliveira is and you give him 30% of Islam Makhachev, that is an even more dangerous fighter. The thing that makes Oliveira less dangerous is his aggression. So I would like, if I was going to be a fighter, I would rather be Charles Oliveira out of the two. But that's because of the excitement factor, of course. If I was going to fight one of the two, I would much rather fight Charles Oliveira, because I feel like Makhachev could do something similar to what GSP did. Like, slow me down, beat me up, and that would be a frustrating night. At least with Oliveira, you know you're going to go out in a blaze of glory if you're there for a fight. So I suppose that's the main reason why. It's such an intriguing one. I mean, don't be surprised if we get a trilogy out of these guys. Don't be surprised if this is a really close fight, or Oliveira wins the first two rounds, he almost gets the finish, and then Makhachev wins the next three and takes the scores. Like, I could absolutely see that happening. And then we'll get the immediate rematch because, of course, you know, people will be calling for it, and it will be worth a lot of money to everybody. Okay, ABC, thank you for the donation. Which fighters do you see getting a finish, and who has the higher chance of an upset, Muhammad or Dariush? I think Dariush is more competitive in his fight than Bilal Muhammad is. I think Bilal Muhammad is really up against it with Sean Brady. I think if I'm Bilal Muhammad, I'm gonna try and do everything I can to hold him off in that first round, to not let him get into his game at all, and then I'm gonna start pressuring him into the second and third. Like, we saw Chiesa kind of run out of time with Sean Brady. I would be thinking about working to his body as well to try and slow him down. But he's just going to be a handful all the way through. Physically powerful, well-conditioned, you know, technically very well-rounded. You can just tell by his decision-making that he's very smart as well. I think this is a really, really tough test for Bilal Muhammad. I mean, I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. It's a good question because Gamrot is an absolute nightmare as well. I mean, really. I don't know. It's a hard question. I expect Gamrot and Sean Brady to both win, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're both decisions. I feel maybe like Gamrot's got a better chance of finishing Dariush than Brady has of finishing Bilal Muhammad. But we'll see. We'll see. I mean, We may potentially be seeing two guys like really validated in the top of the division here. Like, Sean Brady might be progressing to a title shot as an undefeated fighter, which is really exciting. And Gamrot, you look at that split decision loss to Khatatoladze, and that could have gone the other way. You know, Garam even said in the post-fight interview, he was like, "Ah, no, I don't think I won that fight," which is, you know, it was a very admirable thing for him to admit immediately afterwards. I mean, sometimes you in hindsight, you only remember the punches that you get hit with. I've had those fights before, although I have had a few fights where I've been hit with a lot of punches, so that might also explain that. Okay. Ken, you're welcome. There's your answer to your question. What are your thoughts on Oliveira making weight? Is he going to make weight? Is the belt going to be available to him? That's my big question. Okay. Zadie, again, another good question. How would you rate Charles' takedown defense? I don't really think we need to consider it too much, because I think if Makhachev wants to take him down, he'll be able to. You know, the way that Charles Oliveira stuffs your takedowns is by threatening your neck. He's not really sprawling and you know, hand fighting. He's not doing any of those things. If you commit yourself to his to clinching with him, he'll quite happily welcome you in. You know, a lot of the time, I think his takedown defense is, although it's rated as takedown defense, it's because someone's shot in and they've been tangled up. I mean, think about the fights where, you know, someone's tried to wrestle him and he's ended up submitting them before they've even hit the ground. You know, the Nick Lentz fight, jumped on his neck. Miles Jury jumped on his neck, climbed up Efren Escudero, took Will Brooks down, jumped on his back. You know, again, you know, Kevin Lee tried to take him down, caught a kick, tried to take him down and got caught in a guillotine. I mean, that's about as good takedown defense as you need to get in a fight with Makhachev. This is why I think Makhachev's decision-making when it comes to the clinch work is going to determine his success rate and his safety. Because if I'm Makachev, I don't want to be bending at the waist and reaching for his legs, because then I'm putting myself in that head and arm position where he just wraps up that anaconda, that figure four position, and then he's able to magic submissions out of that position like nobody else. If I'm Makachev, though, I know I've got those clinch takedowns. I know I've got those trips and sweeps, that nice harai-goshi that he landed against Leo Kuntz. They'd be the kind of techniques that I'd be looking for, because not only does that keep me body to body, it also means that I'm most likely going to land past the legs of Oliveira if we hit the floor, which, of course, is preferable. If you're double-legging, you might quite easily end up in a guard. Like, look at Cain Velasquez shooting on Fabricio Werdum. Straight into a guillotine. Adam Orton, if Islam gets the late finish, how likely is the sub over a TKO? I think, honestly, they're just as likely as one another. I think there's a real good possibility that Makachev might be able to exhaust Oliveira, defend his submissions, and get him exhausted to a point where he can arm triangle him. Or, I mean, that Kimura is lethal that we saw against Dan Hooker. It wouldn't surprise me because the thing is that the more tired Oliveira gets, the less ability he has to fight back. And he really does crash sometimes. Like, we really do see him, like, he just looks drained against Paul Felder. And like, you know, I've seen a bunch of comments this week, you can't look at their old fights, et cetera, et cetera. Of course you can. You know, I can watch fights of mine from when I was 16, and I can still see habits that I have now. Bad habits, good habits, you know, silly, weird tics that I do. Like, I can still see them now. And there's some of them have found their way all the way through to this point when I'm 40. You know, like, people change, of course, but they don't change that much. Like, if I'm fighting somebody, if I'm preparing one of my fighters for an opponent, I'm watching everything I can find on that opponent. I'm looking at all the stats. I'm taking into account who they fought, of course, but I'm also looking at their stats, because that's going to give me a picture of how their game is constructed. I don't have to pay attention to the opponents, because what I'm looking at is the raw information of where they ply their trade the best. Like, we know Oliveira has got excellent submissions. We know Makachev has got excellent takedowns. Like, they're reflected in their stats. What's also reflected is the fact that Makachev doesn't really take too many shots. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, if he'd have fought Gaethje or Poirier or Chandler, of course that stat would be influenced, but not by a massive amount, because what 0.84 strikes per minute tells you about Makachev is that he's not willing to get hit by his opponents. That's a choice that he's made in his game. Charles Oliveira could have taken a lot less shots than he does. 3.38, I think it is off the top of my head, per minute. He doesn't have to, but he chooses to because of the way that he fights. And that's there's always an insight into stats and into old fights and stuff. The further you go back, the more of a picture you have of that person. Because, of course, you're going to see them evolve. You know, that Paul Felder loss was so important for Charles Oliveira, because that was the moment where he realized that he can give everything in the first round and not have enough. And I think that was a lesson he had to learn again as a lightweight, because he'd already learned that lesson as a featherweight. He'd already learned that lesson against Lamas. He came in 10 pounds overweight for that fight. Against Pettis, that was a struggle to get to the weight cut. And, you know, he gassed and lost in the third round. Against Cub Swanson, he got stopped in the first round because he gassed himself out trying to finish him. You know, it's quite consistent. But it was almost like when he arrived at lightweight, he's like, right, okay, now I've got gas tank for days. And I just don't think he did. And I think that, you know, the version that we've got now is because of that loss against Paul Felder. So you've got to pay attention to these things. That was my little rant. Apologies for that. Justin Carter, thank you. How valuable are flying and clinch knees for Charles Oliveira? Really useful. It was literally the first thing he did against Dustin Poirier. He jumped in with a skip knee. I mean, why not? Like, Khabib used to do it as well. If you're such a good grappler, you have no reason to not go flying at your opponent. Sometimes it's the easiest way to close distance. Like, Khabib would sometimes just run at people and throw both knees just so he could get a hold of them in some way. Usually when you've got someone flying at you, your instinct is to either cover up, which makes you vulnerable, or to reach and grab, which is exactly what they want anyway. And of course, if you're Charles Oliveira, any advantage of being higher up over your opponent, it gives you more chance to attack their neck. I have an old DVD that I used to carry around with me when I was traveling on the road, and it's an SBG instructional called The Higher Man Wins. And not in the Sean O'Malley sense, in the actual physical positional sense. And that's ideal for Charles Oliveira, because his attacks, when he's over you, they're all about the neck and arm. I think anything that he can do to close distance chaotically is a value to him. And I definitely think that those skipping, flying knees are going to be on full display almost immediately. Okay, Stevie Omahey. Is the fight with Diego still on? Haven't heard about it. No. Unfortunately, no. I heard about it yesterday that it's now no longer on for reasons out of my control, which is rather disappointing. I have had a message back and forth with Diego. We are both aware that the fight is now no longer happening, and we have a couple of other options on the table. Maybe be banging bones against one another's faces. We'll see. We'll see what the options are. But I'm waiting on something else coming through today, which I'll be able to tell you about very soon, which will be very exciting. Okay, what do we got? Vanguard, how was it training with Mayhem Miller out in Orange County, California? It was absolute chaos, as you would imagine. I remember we drove out to Temecula, because we used to train at Legends right in the center of Hollywood, and one day he was like, right, I'm going out to train at Team Quest in Temecula where Dan Henderson trains. Do you want to come with me? And of course, I was going to jump at the opportunity to go and train with all those guys. You know, there was a bunch of guys out there. I think Sam Alvey was there. Soka Jew was out there. It was an absolute shark tank. We barely made it alive with Mayhem driving. First of all, he showed up with a massive gold AK-47 around his neck. And I knew that this was going to be a bad ride. He was in a massive truck. I had to climb up into it. And he had a whole stack of stuff on his dashboard that was for finding, you know, the law, so he could go as fast as he liked. And he did go as fast as he liked. This was when he was about as mellow as he could be, and he was still absolutely lethal. Justin Carter, thank you. If Dariush can stop the single from Gamrot, can he keep up in scrambles that keep going to ensue after for three rounds? Yeah, I mean, This is where Gamrot's such a handful to deal with. First of all, the way that he level changes, he's got such a low single. He goes right in below the knee. And then he's quite happy to chase that up to a standing position. He's very athletic, which I feel is something where he's going to edge this fight. He's going to edge this fight against Dariush, given the fact that he's able to just kind of, scramble in ways that Dariush is not going to be able to keep up. I think that low single is going to be problematic, because Dariush is going to be trying to collapse onto it and maybe trying to take his back. And then he's already engaged in a grappling exchange. And of course, Dariush has got really good grappling, but also so is Gamrot. And I mean, anybody that's trained in Poland will know how sore your neck and ankles are. I mean, like, he is going to be attacking things constantly, as well as flowing through and striking. I mean, I've been a big fan of Gamrot for a long time. You know, Veronica speaks very highly of him as well. She's trained with him, and I expect big things from him. This is a really big opportunity for him, and I think he knows it, and I think he's going to take it in his stride. Like, you've got to remember, this is kind of his second career a little bit. Like, he's already been to the top of KSW. Now he's stepped over into the UFC as a relative unknown to a lot of the hardcore UFC to a lot of the non-hardcore UFC fans, and people don't quite realize how lethal he is yet. This might be the opportunity, especially on a big card like this at UFC 280. Jace, does Charles have a glass jaw? No, he doesn't. No, he takes a shot really well. Sometimes I think he does go down without actually being too hurt. I think he plays possum sometimes, trying to get people to chase into his guard. But I think he takes a shot quite well. I mean, of course he gets dropped, but who doesn't get dropped against the likes of Gaethje and Poirier? It's the fact that he's able to recover within 30 seconds, 40 seconds, that's the most amazing thing to me. And that he's mentally unfazed by it. Like, so if you look at that as by comparison with Makhachev, you've got Makhachev's been stopped once, which means that knockout is in the back of his mind. Like, it's a weird thing. Like, the first time, I've only been knocked out once in competition. The first time it happened was the last time it happened. And it's kind of what, I mean, I'll tell you a funny little story. It'll make you laugh at me. I used to, after that fight, it took me a minute to realize that I wasn't going to get knocked out with every shot, because it was weird. I'd walked through what I felt was some really big shots up to that point in my career, and Condit caught me with a perfect counter hook. And, you know, I mean, I was walking onto it, my hand was down, he nailed me, it was clean. And for a second I thought to myself, oh no, is that, like, that's it now I can't take a punch anymore. And I remember going back and watching old Wanderlei Silva highlight reels before my fight, watching him just marching through stuff to land shots. And then I had a couple of scraps. I had a couple of, a couple of good scraps. Chris Lytle, for example, reminded me that it happens. You know, people do get caught. But yeah, I mean, you know, it does kind of, for a minute, it does make you think to yourself, that could happen at any point. And I think after Makhachev got stopped by Adriano Martins, I think he went through that for a couple of fights. I think he's overcome it now, but he will always remember that that's a possibility now. And he did get put down on one knee against Davi Hamos as well. It doesn't happen very often, but if it happens in the first round against Charles Oliveira, I think it's going to have much more of an impact on Makhachev's state of mind than it would Charles Oliveira's, because he does get knocked down. He just picks himself back up again. Dan Hardy in BKFC, maybe. I might bring Wing Chun back. I've been watching too much Ip Man. Okay. M. Love the Warhammer Space Marine in the background. Oh, mate, I forgot to get the one off the shelf in the other room. I have a custom painted one in the other room by my friend Steve Smith. Will you be able to get to it? Yeah. Go on, Jamie. It's on the window ledge in the gym. Yeah, I've got this Blood Angel here. Yeah, that's Jamie just passing by. Just ignore his crotch. I've got the Blood Angel there. I've got the Ultramarine in there that used to be on the set. My friend Steve Smith has painted me one, which is unbelievable. He's put the Outlaw logo on it. He's put Full Reptile logo on it. It's pretty amazing. Nicholas, any prospects from Nottingham? Opinion on Justin Berlinson. Tough dude. Can we see it? Yeah, there we go. Go on, Jamie, you get back across. There's Jamie's crotch again. Bonus material. That'll be the members only section soon. Check that out. It's so cool. Oh, is it? I'll have to post some photos on. I'll just stand in there. I'll have to post some photos on my Instagram about him. It is pretty awesome. Yeah, Justin Berlinson is a tough individual. I'd like to see a little bit more head movement from him. He's a bit too hard headed, and that's what costs him in his fights. I think he's got a lot of potential, but I do think he needs one of those Justin Gaethje kind of mental shifts. After Gaethje lost a couple of times, we saw a shift in his game, and I think we're ready to see that from Berlinson as well. As far as prospects, we've got a bunch of guys. We've got a bunch of guys in the gym. You've got to keep an eye out for Riley Daniels. He's competing all the time in whatever he can compete, and he's doing great. Josh Hamilton's preparing to fight again. Marcus Mee's on the Cage Warriors in November. We've got loads of boys coming through, and a new gym opening in the new year. HW1 Fitness. Check it out on Instagram. Give us a follow. And also give us a subscribe and a like. I mean, I literally forget to say this every time. I walk off and people go, you never said it, did you? No, I didn't. Am I friends with the actor Scott Aitkins? No, I'm not. I don't know who that is. Okay, Justin Carter. Is Jan O'Malley another version of Lineker Andrade? You know, there are some similarities, yeah. There are some similarities. I hope you watch the War Room on the Lineker Andrade breakdown. It's going to be an absolute banger of a fight, that is. There are some similarities. I think there's a real benefit in the fact that Peter Yan trains at Tiger Muay Thai alongside Fabricio Andrade, because, like, the way that he stands, the way that he kicks is, you know, it's long range. You can't close distance on him recklessly. And that's what, I mean, it's a different style of game. Of course, Andrade is much more about kicking, body kicks and knees. However, the respect that you have to have for closing distance against him is similar to the respect that he's going to have for Sean O'Malley. The difference being, of course, is O'Malley's going to most likely attack with his hands over his kicks. But still, you know, you can't just be leaping into range against him. really accurate with his punching. High striking output as well. Okay. Where are we? Loads of questions. Do you stay in contact with Felder at all? No, not really. We kind of like each other's things back and forth. Felder's a good guy. I am really glad that he's on comms this weekend. He could be a mainstay for me, Paul Felder, because he's, I know he does the work. I know he loves it. And he's, you know, he's a funny dude. He's a very, very enjoyable person to work with. As are the majority of them. What army do you collect? Oh, we're going back to Warhammer questions now. Space Wolves was my army. I had Space Wolves and I had some orcs. I've got a little orc down here. What are the questions we got? Whatever. Do I think TJ's on the juice again? No, I don't think he would make that mistake again. I think that'd be really silly of him to make that mistake again. I feel kind of bad for him because it's one of those awkward situations that he's caught in now where he's made the mistake and there's nothing he can do about that mistake, but it's always going to be with him. And it brings everything into question. Like it does the same thing for Anderson Silva for a lot of people. I don't necessarily think Anderson was really using anything through his career. And if he was in a pool of fighters that everybody was, because he wasn't always in the UFC. I certainly feel like Anderson may have been prescribed something or used something while he was healing from his knee and from his leg injury, because he must have had a lot of muscle wastage while that bone was rebuilding itself. But, you know, I mean, the thing is with Dillashaw and EPO is, like, you know what his goal was with it. Like, that's the thing with that drug is you can't really kind of pass it off as something else. It's not, you know, big dick pills or whatever John Jones's excuse was for his tainted supplement. It's EPO. It's for extending your performance, for creating more red blood cells in your body. You know, it does pretty much the same thing as blood doping does, which of course is illegal as well. You know, where you oxygenate the blood, take it from the body, store it, and then put it back in when the body needs oxygenated blood. You know, these are all things that you'll learn from, you know, reading about the Tour de France and the cheating that went on there. It's unfortunate because it will just now follow him. It will just now follow him everywhere. I don't play games nowadays. I'm too old for games nowadays. I just play Sudoku now in the dark. Okay, another question. What do you think of RDA right now and what's next for him? You know what? I won't mind seeing RDA move over to One Championships. Like, I kind of feel like he's come to the point in his UFC career where, I mean, unless you start putting him in there with someone like a Chandler or a Gaethje and we get some of those kind of classic, you know, old gladiators fights, I don't really know what else you're going to do with him. I'd like to see him have a refresh. Like the same thing with Eddie Alvarez. Like, I think he's a free agent now. It would be great if Eddie Alvarez went over to PFL. I think that would be a really good home for him. And, you know, alongside what they've just signed, what, Shane Burgos and Jeremy Stevens, I imagine them picking up RDA, like a couple of other guys that are kind of on their way out of the top 10 in the UFC. Because the reality is, I mean, I've got the rankings pulled up here. Like, you look at the 155 division, like, we're ready for a spring cleaning here at some point in the next sort of, you know, 6 to 12 months. There's a few people in this division that are just not going to be there anymore. Like, Tony Ferguson's down at number 15. You know, he's got Dan Hooker and Jalen Turner above him. We're not going to see Tony Ferguson moving anywhere up in the division. Even if he fights again, like, it's not going to be a matchup that would do him justice. I would rather, if he wants to fight, to have a refresh of his career, put himself in a pool with the likes of RDA and Jeremy Stevens and, you know, maybe make $1 million from PFL. There feels like there's a bit of a changing of the guard coming with the lightweight division. Connor's still sitting there at number 12 as well. And he's been out the testing pool for how long now? I don't know. Who knows? Who knows who's running this thing? It's like a ship with no captain. Okay. How's Owen? Owen is really well. He was over here earlier today. We will bring back Full Reptile Radio at some point. We're just trying to give the channel some structure at the moment. We're trying to, because we've got loads of content. We've got a backlog of stuff that I'd like to get through, things that I want to add to the channel. We're trying to figure out where it's going and how it's going, etc., etc. Okay. Questions? Okay. I will have a go, Doug Smith. I will do my best. I am not a very good jiu-jitsu practitioner, and I have only studied Sambo on the periphery, but I will tell you what I can. So can you explain the subtle differences between between a BJJ practitioner and a Sambo artist? Okay, well, if you compete in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you're competing under a rule set where there is no striking. You're competing under a rule set where you have a variety of different submissions and a lot of different nuances when it hits the floor, and it's much less about control and strike and, you know, stitch submissions onto the end. This for me is why, in my opinion, Sambo is one of the best foundations for mixed martial arts, because it's got a little bit of everything. It's like Sanda. You know, we're seeing a lot of fighters coming through China now who have got a Sanda background. Sanda's very much the same. It's kickboxing with takedowns. Sanda, San Sao, same as Kung Lee does. You know, any traditional martial art which pulls together a few elements of MMA instead of just one element. Like Muay Thai is good because it covers a good portion of the striking arts, but then there are some things that are not incorporated in Muay Thai. There aren't many spinning kicks in Muay Thai, and that's something that's found much more of a home in MMA because the range is slightly longer. So the benefit in being a Sambo practitioner is that of course you've got the awareness of the striking when you're closing distance. Like if you watch Makachev competing in Sambo, like there's one matchup where he dislocates this guy's arm with using his takedown defense, but for the brief moment where you see him standing, he's moving just like he is in MMA. He's throwing his kicks, he's poking with his kicks, his takedown defense is the same. The only real difference is that, of course, they've got jackets. So it adds in like a judo element to it where, you know, there are collar grabs and sleeve control. And you do see him use some of that a little bit in MMA. And, you'll see it with Charles Oliveira as well. But if you watch his fight against Armin Sarukian, for example, you can see there's a moment where he just kind of grabs down the cuff of the glove a little bit. You know, these things happen. People grab shorts and grab gloves and, you know, poke people in the butthole and all these kind of weird things. It's a fight, you know, not my kind of style, but people are into that shit. Hey, whatever. There are certain things that cross over, but a lot of the leg binding, the control from top position that he does, it's all been crafted in on the Sambo mats. With Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, there's far more of a tendency to sit to guard, you know, to start leg entanglements, and there's a whole spectrum of different guards and use of trousers as well, grabbing the pants and, you know, manipulating people's movement with them, pinning, using the pants around their knee. You know, these are all things that you can't do in Sambo because you don't have the pants on. The main thing is striking to grappling, though. I mean, that's the thing that you don't get in most other sports, striking to grappling, and that is a real benefit. Okay. What negative points can Charles' new eyesight have, especially being accustomed to fight? Yeah, I did think this as well. Basically, like, are there any drawbacks in him having his eyes fixed? I don't think there are. I mean, I don't know when he had them done, and I don't know how long he's been working with them, but it seemed to make a big difference positively for Justin Gaethje. And if you think back to Justin Gaethje's old fights before he did have his eyes fixed, he was kind of like zombieing himself into range and getting his hands on his opponent to start hitting them so he knew where they were. Like, you look at Charles Oliveira's fights, and most of the time he's closing them right down so he can get his hands on them. We don't know how much that is so he can be certain where they are, and we might see a much more patient, longer range Charles Oliveira now that's got a much better idea of the distance between him and his opponent. It's an interesting question because we just don't know how it's going to affect him. I can only see it as being a positive, though. What else have we got? I should have another drink. I've got a bunch more questions on Instagram as well. On Twitter. Honestly, I mean, the majority of the questions are about the main event. Like, people are, because it's just such an evenly matched fight. How would the clinch look like between Charles and Islam? Can Islam judo throw him? Yeah, I mean, I think he can. I think Charles will be quite happy to engage and lock up And that's where Islam is going to be able to destabilize him. I just don't think Charles is that bothered. I don't think he feels particularly threatened by hitting the floor with Islam. And, you know, I'm sure he's going to be absolutely fine down there as long as he doesn't run out of gas. That's the point where it changes. Carlos Enrique, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for everybody that's tuned in. I appreciate it. We've got, what, 1,500 people listening? Very cool, very cool. What's Aljo's path to winning here? Really don't see any chance at how he can win. Yeah, I mean, I'm leaning towards Dillashaw, but I also have to take into account that Dillashaw's not, you know, he's not a young fighter anymore. That 2 years out is not ideal for him. You know, we don't know what that's gonna do to his body over the long term. We don't know where his psychology is at. You know, like, this is the other downside to using any kind of performance enhancing drugs, is that you then have that psychological reliance on them because you feel like, oh my goodness, now I don't have that. How do I get back to that? Because we don't know how long he was using them for either. Like, I assume it wasn't very long, but I know EPO is an expensive test, so they don't generally do the test unless they've been, they suspect for one reason or another. They may have been tipped off or whatever, but I don't know. I mean, it's not a usual test that they do, and it's not a cheap one either. So, yeah, I you know, there's lots of questions around it. I always think to myself, because whenever I was fighting somebody, because back in the day, of course, there was hardly any testing, and outside of the UFC, there were a lot of people that would show up looking like a mini shrunk down version of the Incredible Hulk, and I'd think to myself, well, that's not gonna last. I know that's gonna run out, and then when that runs out, so does your confidence. And this is a question with coming back to fighting after a two-year suspension. That must have been really tough for him psychologically. And you just don't know how he's gonna cope if Aljo starts to run away with this. You know, if he catches him in the face with a kick and cuts him like the cut he got against Corey Sandhagen, you know, that could quite easily be stopped if it was an inch across his eyebrow. There are lots of ways that TJ can lose this. Aljo's a tough, stubborn guy. He knows how to compete. He's got good wrestling. He can scramble to the back. You know, he's got long arms and legs. He's going to be able to sting Dillashaw with his kicks from a distance. I think there are lots of good ways for Aljo to win. I think he can absolutely steal a decision here by outpointing Dillashaw and walking him onto shots and keeping the reminder of that level change there. I am leaning towards Dillashaw, but I am also aware that there might be a little bit of wishful thinking on my part that he is the Dillashaw of old, because he might not be. He might not be. A lot of Charlie Olive's fans in the chat, which is cool to see. Okay, what else have we got? What else have we got? Best of a drink. Goodness. Who's going to steal the show? That's a good question. You know, there are so many good fights on this card. You can kind of, there's a few fights lower down that I think are going to be real bangers. I'm very excited to see Markayev's performance. I think Malcolm Gordon is a bit of a wild card. He's very chaotic and a bit dangerous. If, you know, I mean, you remember what he did to Dennis Bandar's arm. You know, he could quite easily pop an elbow and, you know, kind of take you out of the fight in the long run at some point. But I've just been supremely impressed with Markayev. He's very kind of grounded and mature for his age. He's got experience in IMAF. You know, I think he's a real problem. I think he's a real problem. I'm excited for his fight. I also think that the middleweight fight, Muradov against Bahayo, is a really interesting one, because again, both guys have got a lot of potential to become real stars. You know, in the very near future, they're both right on the cusp, and I think it might be this performance that gets them there. I'm thinking Markayev's going to steal the show, though. I can see him getting a finish. Who else we got? Can Islam live up to the hype against a top-ranked opponent? Yeah, I think he can. This has been a topic of conversation for a while now. People going, well, you know, but what about the level of opposition? And you have to remember a couple of things. One is that he's been in Khabib's shadow for a long while. Like the UFC as a promotion couldn't accelerate him too quickly because they couldn't have him banging into Khabib. They didn't want him as the number one contender while Khabib was still the champion. It didn't make any sense to progress him any faster. But now Khabib is out of the way and he's now sitting in the coach's position. There's no reason why they can't accelerate Makhachev and hope he becomes something close to what Khabib was when he was competing. Because, I mean, they could really do with that. What you don't want is one person at the top of the division kind of just holding it down. And you look at Oliveira's record so far, like, you could quite easily see him, you know, positioning himself in a strong enough situation to just be able to defend the belt against everybody that comes to face him. Like Chandler, Poirier and Gaethje, that clears out the top of the division pretty much, right? The next up is Makhachev, and then you're into Dariush, who's potentially going to lose to Gamrot this weekend, Fiziev, RDA, who I just don't see as being much of a challenge to either of these guys. Like, it's going to take a minute to filter some more fighters through. If Makhachev isn't able to compete with Oliveira, then you've got to start looking for other potential matchups down the rankings. And I just don't think most of them are ready yet. And I think because Charles Oliveira is absolutely ready, it's the same situation with GSP, right? It's the same situation when he was the champion of the division. Like, there were a bunch of guys in that division. And if the whole top of the division was competitive, I would have probably had to fight two or three of them. I would have had to have fight a Thiago Alves or a Josh Koscheck or a John Fitch. But because GSP had already beaten them and beaten them so soundly that they were like, okay, who we got? Then you start getting people being brought through from the bottom of the division that are not quite ready to be there yet. You know, not saying that they won't be at some point, like Armin Sarukian is absolutely capable of being right up near the top. And I think there are other people in the division, Fiziev, of course, but they might not be ready for Charles Oliveira just yet. So what the UFC as a promotion could do with is Makhachev to show up in this fight and at least give a good enough account for them to call for a rematch. Even if it's not immediate, because they've got Volk waiting in the wings, it's always good if you're the promotion to have two options. And two options ideally would be Makhachev as a rematch if he doesn't win this time, or Volkanovski. Okay. What else we got? Will Yan fight the same after his last loss? I mean, against wrestlers in the future. I think he has to start quicker this time around. I think he has to... You know, you go back to his fight against Taruto Ishihara, where he closed him down pretty quickly. That's the kind of performance that we need to see from him against Sean O'Malley. There are certain elements of Petr Yan's game that are really, really useful to him. Like, he's very, very good at reading the straight punches and slipping to the outside of them and either countering with straight shots or grabbing a single necktie. I also think that he can make Sean O'Malley work more than he wants to at close range by wrestling him, you know, grabbing him around the body, you know, slipping, tripping him, that foot sweep that Makhachev does, you see it in Petr Yan's game as well. I think the way that Petr Yan loses this fight is by giving O'Malley too much time and space in the first round. It's not that he won't be moving forward, because that's his only way of fighting, but I do think that the intensity with which he does it will determine his success over the long run. And as I said, I think if this was a 5-round fight, Petr Yan would be able to get to him in the last couple of rounds. But I think over 3 rounds, there's enough time for O'Malley to do what he needs to do to win. Okay. Okay. Will Charles mentally slow down, give up after the third, especially if nothing worked? I mean, that is the concern. I think it's a lot less likely if he doesn't have a battle with the scales, but I do think he might. I mean, the reality is we don't know what he looks like in the fourth or fifth round because he's not been there. I know that, I mean, you go back way earlier in his career and he's had 3 fights in the same night before and won them all and stopped everybody, and he's still not done enough to amount to a full 3 rounds. Like, he might surprise us. He might come in with amazing conditioning over 25 minutes, and we might see a different side of his game, especially if he's got his eyes fixed. Then now he can work a bit more with a bit more space, so he's not as hittable. You know, his fights might start to extend a little bit, but I don't know. Ultimately, I think that's his mode. I think he just kicks himself into fourth gear as the bell goes, and he just goes at his opponent. And then he's got that fifth gear if he needs it. But after fifth gear, he's back down to second, and that's where Makhachev starts to take over. Mark, thank you. Do you not love the RDA Barbarena matchup? Yeah, I mean, I do love it. I think as a scrap, it is really as a really fun one to watch. But there's just no real upward trajectory for either of them. I mean, do you see either of them fighting for a title? I think that, you know, someone like RDA with the name that he's got, he could cash in on that name in some bigger fights with some other fighters. I just don't know if he's going to get these opportunities. What else we got? I mean, Barbarain is an absolute dog, isn't he? He's like, I mean, you watch how difficult he was against Leon Edwards, and you think to yourself, yeah, he'd be a nightmare of a fight for anybody, Barbarena would. Just like a tough, durable, never give up, never slow down. Okay, well, I mean, Manuel Sanchez, Charles versus Islam, who wins and what round and how? I mean, I expect in the first two rounds, Charles is most likely going to come close to winning. And I think he's got a real good possibility of winning. However, I think if he doesn't in the first couple of rounds, then he's going to start to struggle. What's my success record with predictions since you've been doing the War Room? Well, I mean, you'd have to look at my predictions on the Picks podcast. I don't make predictions on the War Room. I think... See, it's always interesting when I see these comments, like, well, you know, you're wrong. Like, there might be something I say, an opinion that I hold that you might, oh, Jamie, bless you. There might be an opinion that I have that you might disagree with, but ultimately I don't make a prediction in the War Rooms. I never have. I will lean towards one fighter. Sometimes I'll lean heavily towards one fighter if I feel like it is going to go that way. But the majority of the time I try and give it as objectively as I can based on all the possibilities. Like, I don't know. My track record with Pixies, though, probably not very good. This is why I don't put any money on these things, because it's too chaotic. MMA is too chaotic for any kind of certainty. Like, anybody saying 100% anything, you're full of shit. You just can't do it. Not in MMA. What do you think to Paul Hughes versus Jordan Vachenik? I think it's going to be one of the best. One of the best local fights that we have seen in the UK for a long, long time. They're both very, very good. They're both very skilled. You know, Jordan Vachenik's striking is fantastic, but then we saw him against James Hendon scramble up and choke him out. We know how tough and how durable and how determined Paul Hughes is and how hard he trains. Both very well-rounded martial artists. I wouldn't like to pick it either way. I'll be looking forward to watching it. Okay, Charles Teddy go down to 145 to fight Volk for that double champ status in Australia. Do you think he physically can? I don't. I really don't. I would be very, very surprised if he was able to get back down to 145 now. I think it would take a supreme amount of discipline and some experts who he could do with around him now, and I don't think he's got them. So to bring him in to go back down to 145, I just don't see it. Rami, Aubin Mercier versus Stevie Ray. I tell you what, Stevie Ray's impressed me no end in his recent couple of fights. And Pettis is a very difficult individual to beat. Aubin Mercier, of course, you know, a durable martial artist. He's evolved so much since he was in the UFC. Great boxing, great clinch work, great wrestling. Difficult one to pick either way, to be honest. I'm leaning towards Stevie Ray because, you know, especially when I saw him on Polaris a little while ago, and of course what he did with that weird kind of body triangle twister against Pettis, I think there's a new level to Stevie Ray's ground game, which Aubin Mercier might run into. He might be smart to keep this fight standing, and then it's much more of a 50-50. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if Stevie Ray gets the finish. After being taken down, he might end up getting the finish himself. Okay. Captain Fluffy 25. Sorry, my friend, I must have missed you. What about my donation in regards to Gamrot potentially being a champion? Gamrot has absolutely got the potential to be a champion. This is what I was talking about with this division. Soon he's going to look very different because the top few of the division, as well as a couple of other people that are now further down, they're going to be gone soon. They're not going to be around. Not for any other reason other than they're just kind of winding down to the end of their careers. You know, you kind of start to hear it from, like, Poirier, he's only going to fight big fights now. Like, he's had two shots at the belt. Is it two shots at the belt? I mean, unless he gets another title shot, in which case he's going to have to beat, you know, one or two of the other people in the top five, top 10. I think all of these guys are now going to start to look like maybe 5-6 fights left in their career. And then they'll start moving on. And then we're going to see a whole new stock of lightweights coming through. And lightweights, you know, it's been one of the roughest divisions for a long while. But the experience that Mateus Gamrot got outside of the UFC and KSW, and when he arrived in the UFC, already being such a well-seasoned, finished product of a martial artist, you know, I think, honestly, he had that fight against Khatatiladze, which was so evenly matched. It was such a good fight to watch. I think people kind of go, oh, he should have had a very explosive UFC debut, I think, to do him justice. And I think that because it was such a close fight, people kind of dismissed him straight away. And I think that was a mistake because he's been quietly simmering in the background now. And I think Dariush is his opportunity to make a statement, and I think he will. Okay. We've been going for some time, haven't we now, Jamie? Hour and six, is it? I can't believe people would still want to listen to me for that long. Okay. Tima Beck, whose wrestling is better, Khabib's or Makhachev's? Well, I mean, at this point, I don't think you can steer anybody away from Khabib's wrestling and how proven it is. But I do think Makhachev is on the trajectory to be a great MMA fighter. He already is, but he's you know, as his level of competition steps up, we're going to see new levels to his game. And I think one day in the future, we'll be talking about him as one of the best for sure. Kickzoo3, what is the most exciting division in the UFC for now, in your opinion? I mean, I can give you reasons why I'm excited for the majority of them, to be honest. In every division, there's someone that really draws my attention. I think some divisions are more locked down than others, like featherweights waiting for a resurgence. You know, like I don't know as we're going to see Rodriguez get. I don't think we're going to see Rodriguez get the belt around him. I think he's going to be a problem in the top of the division for a while. But we're looking down the division at the likes of Arnold Allen, Movsar Evloev, you know, Giga Chikadze. They're the kind of fighters that we're going to see coming through at featherweight, and they're the ones that are making me excited. Ilya Topuria, another good one. Really, really dangerous. And then same with welterweight as well. We're going to see a real changing of the guard soon. I think we're going to see some of these young fighters, some of the Shavkats moving up in the division to really start stirring things up. Middleweight has probably been is about the best that it's been in the history of the UFC, I would say, middleweight division. It was great when Anderson Silva was there, but then it was only great for a short period of time because he kicked the shit out of everybody and then there was nobody else there to fight him. And, you know, Anderson Silva's career in its own right was brilliant because you just follow this amazing martial artist as he goes up a weight class, beats somebody up, comes down a weight class, defends his belt, goes up a weight class, beats somebody up, calls out Roy Jones, doesn't get it, beats somebody up boringly because he's sulking and he's angry at the UFC for not letting him. Like, he was, you know, he was a really interesting study in his own right. But as a division, there's a lot of interesting people at middleweight right now. I mean, Adesanya against Pereira, of course. I'm going to be doing a breakdown of that very soon. That's a really fascinating one. We're going to do a breakdown of their previous fights in kickboxing and then talk a bit about how they match up in MMA and the history that's going into it. You know, Whittaker's up there as a perennial contender. I could quite easily see him, you know, being in contention for a belt another time if he doesn't get it back. Jared Cannonier will always surprise me. Marvin Vettori is just a tough orc. I love watching him fight. I don't expect it to be any kind of finesse or beauty, but I think he is a hard-nosed battle for everybody. Derek Brunson is a problem for people to solve, but I'm not much of a fan of his style. It has always looked a little bit reckless, and the times when he's come unstuck is exactly why I don't like his style, because he's kind of a bit chin up and a bit chaotic. I mean, that division's solid. If I'm watching one fighter in that division right now, it's Andre Muniz. That slide off the back armbar that he's nailed twice in the UFC now is quite special. And I really think that we're going to see him progress towards a belt. And because he's the antithesis of everybody at the top of the division now, you know, the middleweight division's full of strikers. We've got somebody coming through with slick jiu-jitsu, kind of replaces the Jacare that we're missing in the division right now. Okay. Hashashin. Who do I think Cyril should fight? I mean, I think he should fight John Jones, really. I think everyone should fight John Jones in the heavyweight division because I want to see John Jones come back. I think Cyril against Stipe is an interesting fight. I think Aspinall, when he gets back in there, will be an interesting fight for Cyril. I think he's maybe a fight or two away from that right now, especially with him being out. We've just got to throw John Jones into the mix. That's what's most interesting about the heavyweight division. And somebody asked me this question the other day about Francis Ngannou and John Jones, and if Jones fought him now, could he beat him? And I think at this point, I would lean towards Jones as being the favourite. But the reality is, the longer he leaves it, the lower his chances are. Because when, you know, Ngannou's now got some grappling and he's now started to harness his physical attributes in an MMA way like he's never before. And that's a scary thing. Like, you know, Jairzinho Rozenstruik is a good kickboxer, a really good kickboxer. He's got 60-something fights on his record, lots of knockouts. He's been a kickboxer at heavyweight for a long time. He's been dealing with big heavyweights that hit hard. Ngannou practically decapitated him. And that was just foot on the gas, revved the engine, okay, now we're going. And there are very few people in the world that can stand in the way of that and deal with it. And my question is, can John Jones? I mean, I think he has the height and the reach to be able to match Ngannou, but I don't think he can generate that kind of power. Absolutely not. I don't think many people in the division can. And if he can't generate that kind of power, what does he do to deal with that kind of power? Because at light heavyweight, John Jones was supremely capable. You know, he was taller than everybody, had a longer reach than everybody. He'll still have a longer reach than everybody in the heavyweight division as well. 84.5 inches his reach is. He's still going to have some physical attributes that are a benefit to him in the heavyweight division. Not like they were at light heavyweight. You know, he's not going to be fighting many guys that are shorter than him. Like, if you look at him compared to Machida, you think to yourself, well, you know, he shouldn't have been able to touch you really with the length of your arms and your height. But stepping up to heavyweight, he foregoes some of these advantages. Like, we know that he's not going to be the tallest with the longest reach and the sharpest elbows and the hardest punch, because now he's fighting other people that can replicate that kind of power or surpass it. That's the intrigue here. And I think the longer he leaves Francis Ngannou to prepare for him, because you've got to make no mistake, Francis Ngannou's not preparing for anybody else in his mind. He wants that John Jones fight because he wants that big money. And that's the payday for him. Like, you get John Jones in the octagon against Francis Ngannou and the money will roll in. That is Ali Frazier. That is, yeah, it's a big fight. How funny would it be if Izzy walked out in the main event wearing a Dagestani hat or wrestling gear? Yeah, I think it would be really, really, I think it'd be even smarter if he spent some time doing some wrestling in Dagestan. But I don't know. I think Izzy's going to see this one as being a slightly different style of fight, given the fact that it's the smaller gloves and it's in the octagon instead of a ring. It's much easier to get caught in the corner in a ring. It's much easier to get trapped, especially if you've got someone who walks forward like Pereira. And those big gloves don't really help Adesanya. Like, if you're a big puncher, it doesn't really matter the size of the gloves. Like, you could wrap Mark Hunt's fist in a mattress and he's still going to probably knock out most people that he punches. But if you take someone who's got a 10-ounce glove on and you take that glove and put it in a 4-ounce glove, you took that hand and put it in a 4-ounce glove, Their power doesn't change, but the speed of the punch changes slightly because the weight of the glove is different, and it doesn't seem like much, but it does make a difference over the distance. The other thing as well that you've got to remember is that the gaps that a 4-ounce glove will fit through is different to the gaps that a 10-ounce glove will fit through. It's much easier to defend yourself with 4-ounce gloves. Adesanya's got good hand fighting, good wrist control. He's very good with trickery on the inside. And he's also good at avoiding shots with the, you know, the narrowest of margins. That narrowest of margin is not necessarily there with a bigger glove. So if he's fighting Alex Pereira in bigger gloves, Pereira's going to hit him more. It's just a simple fact. He might be able to cover himself a bit more, but he's still taking that power and he's still being backed into corners. I'm not going to go too much into it now because I will do a full breakdown on it, but it is a very different fight. And I think that Adesanya is going to take a lot of confidence from the fact that he's got small gloves and a lot more space to work with. What will happen to Jones if Ngannou will do the same as he did against Rozenstruik? This is the thing because you think someone like Rozenstruik would have had options if someone charged at him, and he just didn't he seem to know what to do. He just kind of froze up and got knocked out. Like, I would expect John Jones to have some plans in place, you know, something that would meet that kind of force coming forward. Like, this is what I was talking about with the Thai boxing match that's been cancelled, Superlek. Yeah, the Superlek fight that was cancelled on this one championship. The best thing to use against someone that comes sprinting forward in a straight line is smashing elbows. And John Jones is very good at elbows. He's very good at what he calls locking horns and rolling over the sides and hitting with elbows. These are things that he could use against Ngannou. But ultimately, I think what he'll do is he'll find himself safe positions to tie up and to smother, to turn him against the fence, hold him and make him work, head position, stomp on his feet, and like make those heavy arms, those powerful arms of Francis Ngannou, those big shoulders, start to fill up with blood and make them burn. And then those punches, I mean, they might still hit with the same force, but they don't travel with the same speed. And if I'm John Jones, I'm going to feel far more comfortable trying to get out of the way of one of those big winging shots if Ngannou's already tired. There was a good question about oblique kicks, but damn thing keeps refreshing itself. Where was it? Okay. If you could, would you have fought your UFC career at 55 or in the 170 weight? I mean, in hindsight, I could have probably gone down to 155. I fought at 160 twice, but I was always a welterweight, and when I arrived in the UFC, like the welterweights were a bit smaller. Like, you know, I was generally as tall as most of the welterweights I was fighting. Mike Swick was a bit of an anomaly because he came down from middleweight and he was really long and wiry. And then of course the other anomaly is Anthony Johnson, who should have probably never been a welterweight in the first place. I was in the right weight class for the time, but if I was fighting in the UFC now, definitely I would be a 55er, and I would have to be a lot more disciplined with my diet to get there as well. I tell you that, because I mean I'm about 200 pounds now, and I used to start training camp at about 205. But I would also get up to 215 between fights as well. So I used to generally be a bit bigger. I used to lift a lot more and a lot heavier as well. And I used to forcibly eat a lot more, which I don't do anymore. Yeah. My diet, everything changed. Like when I stopped fighting, I decided that I was just going to let my body do what it wanted to do. Eat when I was hungry. And it was a pretty cool experiment for a while. I tended to find that I wouldn't eat for most of the day, and then I would just eat a little bit more during the evenings. And I always used to struggle to get up in the morning and eat and then go to the gym to train. And in hindsight, I just wouldn't force myself to do it now. I'd let my body kind of balance itself out and just make sure I was taking in overall the right amount of calories. Okay. Stanley Moon, apparently I was too crazy when I fought. I think anybody that fights is crazy, to be honest. Paddy Pimblett does like to eat. My goodness, Paddy Pimblett likes to eat. But I tell you what, he has the discipline. So when it comes time to lose the weight, he decides he's going to drop it, and it does. Very, very impressive. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's good for him in the long run, doing it over and over again. But the fact that he's able to just kind of switch off that part of himself and go, no, okay, now we're weight cutting now. That's very impressive. I always struggled to get back on a diet after I came off, which is why I never really came off my diet too much. I just ate a lot more, and then I got addicted to Subway cookies. Yeah, that's a whole other story though. What else we got? I'll have a couple more questions and then we'll go. With your knowledge now, would you fight GSP differently? Absolutely, I would. Matthew Mullen, thanks for the question. Yeah, I would. But honestly, I mean, it's like if you could know what you know now and go back to do your exams when you're at school, wouldn't you feel more confident? I mean, I would feel generally like I would be able to handle the whole school process a bit easier now, and I would have been a lot smarter as a fighter if I'd have had the brain that I've got now. But I mean, this is the process of being a martial artist. Unfortunately, sometimes you get to a stage where the lessons that you learn them at the point when your athletic peak has passed. And I'm not saying that about myself. I mean, I was probably never going to be, with the guys that were in the division with me, it wouldn't have made too much of a difference whether I was at 155 or 170. Like, there were absolute killers around me, and I was a couple of years behind technique wise. I was just fortunate enough to have a striking level which kind of kept me competitive with some of the guys in the division, and I had some bangers of fights. But I mean, if I knew what I knew now, I would do a lot of things different. I'd be a lot more forgiving of myself as well. Like, I used to push myself through training camps knowing full well that I was not physically well enough to be doing it. And I still pushed myself to do it because I thought that was the right thing to do. And now, it's far more of a business now. We got into this debate on the podcast, and I've had the conversation several times with people about Aljamain Sterling and what happened in the Peter Yan fight. And, I genuinely feel bad for the guy, because he was put in a situation where he had to put on a performance, and he was already sailing down that river. He couldn't stop. He couldn't turn it around and go, oh, no, I'm okay, I'm fine now. Because the referee had waited for 5 minutes to call the fight off. It's an unfortunate situation, but like in that situation, I probably wouldn't have done the same thing, and that would have been a stupid thing to do probably. I mean, well, you tell me. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure what your opinion is. Anthony Smith. Should he have stayed down and taken the belt off Jones? I don't know. Interestingly, when DC was talking about it in the commentary when Aljo was still on the floor against Peter Yan, he referred to what Anthony Smith did as taking the high road. And I mean, I think as a competitor, I think we all want to see people just no matter what, arms hanging off, legs hanging off, can't see, doesn't matter, get me back in there. There are certain moments and memories that stick out in my mind of fighters in fights, things that they did, decisions that they made, ways that they acted, and they stand out as either being positive or negative. And a good example of a positive one for you, and one of my favorite fighters of all time is Enson Inoue. Him and his brother Egan were both fantastic fighters, but Enson was he had the die in there kind of attitude. He was samurai through and through, Yamato Damashi. Go back and watch his fight in Pride against Igor Vovchanchin, because Vovchanchin was an exceptional fighter, a Ukrainian fighter with really good high kicks, kind of little short and tubby and powerful, but he had great skills. Enson came out in that fight, gi bottoms on, came out absolutely swinging, going wild. He lost his balance. He got knocked down in the first minute or so. And you remember the first round of Pride was 10 minutes. So he's sitting on the floor with Igor Vovchanchin in his guard, pounding him in the head for 10 minutes. At the end of the round, he couldn't get up, physically couldn't get up. His corner team came in and they picked him up under the arms and they dragged him back and they sat him against the pad in the corner. And his eyes were swollen shut, so he couldn't see the fingers the doctors were holding up, and he couldn't get onto his stool, and he was just in no fit state to continue. But when the referee came over and waved it off, and it's kind of haunting at the same time, like you can hear him in the background going, no, no. It, honestly, like it was a life or death situation. Not, it wasn't sport for Ensign in a way, and it's not sport for a lot of people in there. And it wasn't for me. It was sport outside, but as soon as the cage door was locked, it was game on. Like, kill me or whatever. I was there for the 15 minutes and no longer. And I don't know. I always kind of gravitate towards that. That's, I guess, why my pick is Dillashaw over Aljo, because I don't see that element in Aljo. And the way that I see Charles Oliveira losing is when that part of him, which might be so deep buried inside underneath muscle mass and confidence and conditioning, et cetera, but at the same time, I still kind of feel like that is down in there somewhere. And if I went back... I had a fight once again. I'm talking too much about myself, aren't I? This has turned into Bisping's channel. Fucking hell. I had a fight once a long time ago, like 1937 or something like that, I think it was. And I saw this guy tap to strikes in one of his earlier fights. It annoyed me so much. I was expecting him to tap to strikes when I got in a good position, and he did. And he was tapping so hard that I kept punching him, and I was not satisfied with the finish, because, you know what I mean? I kind of felt like he should have been in there a bit more. yeah, I am talking too much about myself. I need to stop. I don't know. It's an instinct thing for me. I want to see someone in there that's going to compete until the very last. Someone that's going to give everything. And even if that means that you don't win the fight, you don't win the belt, whatever. And I'm just talking on instinct now. Probably the smart thing to do is exactly what Aljo did. I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't hurt by the knee, absolutely. I'm just saying he wasn't that hurt after 4 minutes of being on the floor. Yeah. Okay. I've dissected all the fights apart from the main event. I feel like I've talked a lot about the main event. Have I not? Okay, well, let me talk a little bit about the main event then. What do you want to know? What do you want to know? Where's my notes? I've got loads of notes on this. Okay, I mean, ultimately, this is my thought in a nutshell, a massive nutshell, because I'm going to talk about this for a few minutes. I think Oliveira is going to start fast. I think he's going to try and close Makhachev down, because if I'm Oliveira and I'm looking at Makhachev, I'm thinking to myself, this is the first time he's been in a title fight. He's fighting for Khabib's belt. There's a lot of pressure on his shoulders. I'm going to put it on him. Oliveira's also got 33 wins and 8 losses on his record, 41 fights, compared to Makhachev, who's got, what, 22 fights? Is he 22 and 1 into? Yeah, 23 fights. So you've got to think that the experience of being in a world title fight is going to be far more of a shock for Makhachev than it is for Oliveira. We also know that Oliveira can walk through a knockdown in the first round and still get the fight finished. So I expect him to go foot on the gas, get right in Makhachev's face and try and get him backed up against the fence. So Makhachev's kicking game is now kind of shut down. Then I think Oliveira starts flowing. We'll start seeing some of those skip knees, some of those elbows, a bit of chaos to kind of close distance. And then he'll try and get his hands on Makhachev and get him to the floor by any means necessary, even if he ends up on the bottom position. And I think that first round is going to be a mad tussle. But I do think that Charles Oliveira is going to be willing to strike. I just think he's going to be the first one to initiate the takedown. And then, you know, ultimately then we see where Charles Oliveira's gas tank is. We see how hard his weight cut was, how good his training camp was, and, you know, how long he can sustain the pace that he normally fights at. Like, of course, against Poirier, he was fine into the third round. It's rare that we see him into the third round, and it's also rare that we see him aggressive in the third round. I can see Makhachev starting to take over. If Makhachev's getting off his stool at the end of the second round and he's walking into the center to the beginning of the third, I expect Charles Oliveira to be the more tired out of the two. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's two rounds up on the scorecards, maybe even a 10-8. Doesn't mean to say that that's it now, he's won the fight, because in a championship fight, of course, in the main event, there are three more rounds, and that's where Makhachev, I feel, starts to come on. And I think smart game plan in the corner of Makhachev as well, because you've got to think, like, Khabib is not just going to let Makhachev deal with this himself. Khabib is going to be looking at Oliveira as a potential opponent for himself, not necessarily because he will be fighting him, because I don't think he'll come back, but that's the way he'll break him down. Like, that's the way that I would break down anybody that I was preparing a game plan for. I would put myself in the position of fighting them, and I would always try and do it from their perspective. So what are their skills and how do they fit with their opponents? With Khabib being the coach of Makhachev and having a very, very similar skill set in a lot of ways, there are like Khabib will probably know his route to victory against Oliveira, and that's what he'll probably be trying to get to Makhachev to do. I also think Makhachev's probably got better striking at range though than Khabib, his kicks, etc. So that does give another element to his game, but I feel like that's nullified by Charles Oliveira's aggression. I mean, really interesting stuff when it comes to their statistics. I've got all the UFC averages here for these, and how they compare is really interesting. So the UFC average for knockdowns per 15 minutes is 0.3. Makhachev's is 0.27 and Charles Oliveira is 0.51. You know, striking output is really high compared as well, above the UFC average. Makhachev's is below the UFC average. But then striking defense, UFC average striking defense is 56.4%. Makhachev is 68.6. So he's way ahead of the UFC average, and Oliveira sits below at 52.2. I mean, the stage is set for Makhachev to have more success in the striking and the wrestling, but ultimately lose the fight because Oliveira's got such a broad skill set. I hope that answered your question, my friend. Okay. We should probably start wrapping it there, should we? We got any more last questions? Let me see. Let me see if anything stands out. Okay, here's one. Fight Mind, we'll call this the last question. Does Islam hit hard enough to knock down Charles? Because I don't think Charles will voluntarily go to the ground the way he did against Justin or Dustin. Now, I think he did. Well, I still think he was dazed by those shots. The one against Gaethje hurt him because it cut him as well. You know, you could see the way his head snapped back when he got hit with that. He was moving on to it. That shot hurt him. I do think Makhachev can knock him down, yes, absolutely. And I think Makhachev, knowing that he can commit to his left hand like he did against Gleison Tibau, level change underneath for a takedown. I mean, that's ideal game plan for Makhachev in the later rounds when Charles Oliveira starts to slow down. Because I still think Makhachev would prefer to be in top position than striking when Charles is tired. Did I answer the question? Yeah, so ultimately I do think Makhachev can knock him down. But I also think that Charles, even if he is dazed and he's not really necessarily going down, I still think he might tempt Makhachev. I still think he might, especially if he's not been able to do anything. He's not been able to take him down himself. He's not been able to wrap his neck or anything like that. And now, you know, Makhachev is moving and kicking and level changing. And, you know, if he's starting to outpoint Oliveira, absolutely, Oliveira might take a shot and fall to the floor. He might give Makhachev that excitement. Oh, I got him. Like, we saw it in the Gleison Tibau fight. He was intending to hit him to level change onto square legs and take him down. And when he realized he was knocked out, there was a surprise as well as an excitement there. But he can commit to his punches because he's got a level change underneath. I just don't know, is that level change be as smart against Charles Oliveira with his neck attacks? Okay, I think we'll wrap it there. What do I make of Oliveira's new improved eyesight? I mean, I think it's a benefit to him, of course. I think of course it's a benefit to him. Anything where you can see your meal is going to be a benefit. I wonder how much time he's had to adapt to it, because, you know, he's got to change his striking at range. He does stand very close to his opponents, and I do feel like that's a big part down to so he knows where they are and where he can get his hands on them. Okay, we'll call it there, Jamie. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I'm going to try and do these every week so I can chat with you guys, especially ahead of the big events. And I like your questions. It feeds my brain and it challenges me, and your company is always very welcome on the channel. Like and subscribe, please, and thank you for all the donations. That's very kind of you. And we'll see you again.